I like that part in the middle of your hair. No painted cheeks, no painted lips. You look just like those homegirls with all their innocence from Europe yet.
Is this the way you talk to girls the minute you meet them? I laughed back at him.
With a swift glance, he took in everything in my room. Your sister was making excuses for the way you live. I think more of you for standing on your own feet. I lived worse when I ran away from home. You and I are so much alike because I too wanted to make my own way in the world, and you remind me of my own beginning.
That man could wake the dead from their graves. Where was my discouragement now? My eyes could only follow his eyes. His slender body was all joyous youth, full red lips. His hands and feet like wired electricity. I felt I'd be afraid to touch even the tips of his fingers for fear I'd get shocks.
Tell me about your running away.
I edged my chair nearer to him in my excited eagerness. His face was kindled with pleasure. It was like inviting him to a feast to ask him to talk about himself. I still see that first day when I got off the ship with my little bundle on my back. I was almost lost in the blowing snow of a freezing blizzard. Then I came upon a gang of men clearing the street with great shovels. At once I saw that these men must be paid for their work, so I pushed myself in among them and begged for a shovel. The big fat foreman looked down on the poor little greenhorn, wondering should he take pity on me. But before waiting for an answer, I snatched up a shovel from the stack and dug into the snow. At the end of the day, when I was paid a dollar, I felt the riches of all America in my hand. This first money I had to pay down for a week's lodging. The next day there was no more snow shoveling. I was hungry. I had to get work, and I didn't know where. I just walked the streets searching people's faces, driven by hunger. Then I saw an old man struggling with his pushcart over the frozen snow. I rushed up to him, begging him with my eyes and my hands to let me help him. So he gave me the job to drive his pushcart and holler for him, "Pay cash, clothes!"
How could you manage the English words that first day? I asked.
A humorous twinkle leaped into Max's eyes. That man knew as much about English as I. What I hollered was, "Pay cats, coals!" But my boss couldn't tell the difference. To me, it was only singing a song. I didn't understand the words, but my voice was like dynamite, thundering out into the air all that was in my young heart, alone in a big city.
The rest of the story flowed on like magic. At the end of the week, he was in business for himself. He cried the streets, "Pay cats, coals!" without even a pushcart. From all the windows, people began to look with wonder at the strange greenhorn singer. Every day he came back to his lodging loaded full with piles of old clothes. In a month, he had enough money saved to start a little stand of second-hand clothes in Hester Street. That day I felt so happy with my riches that I danced and sang in front of my goods to make people come and buy, he went on. Such a free theater as I gave them. Hester Street never saw and never heard such acting and dancing and singing in their whole life. Then a man from the crowd came over and said, "Young man, you're too smart to waste yourself selling second-hand clothes in Hester Street. I'll make you for an actor. I'll give you $25 a week to dance and sing on the stage in my theater on Grand Street." And so for a while he became an actor and earned a lot of money.
But I began living a fast life, bumming around like a gay young feller with the women. One night after a drinking party, going out from an overheated place, I caught cold. It went worse till it turned into consumption. The doctor told me I'd have to leave the stage and live outdoors if I wanted to save my life.
A new chance to get on his feet came to him in California. In a town near Los Angeles, he started a little stand of imitation jewelry, so he saved up enough to open a small general store. And now, after a few years, it has grown to be the biggest department store in the village. Every step of his struggle to rise, he painted with such colorful pictures, it was like turning the pages of a wonderful book right there with him. By the time he had finished his story, I had forgotten all about myself. I gazed up at him, feeling like a tiny ant at the feet of a great lion.
"Think only, I never yet went inside a school or a college in America," he went on, "and I have American-born college men working for me as bookkeepers and salesmen. I can hire them and fire them as it wills itself in me, because with all their college education, they haven't got the heads to make the money that I have."
I didn't like this last boast of his. But I was so carried away by the man himself that I wasn't aware how much I didn't like it. He began telling me of his real estate investments that he had scattered all over Los Angeles. He pictured the wonders of this city of his. Bungalows full of sunshine and flowers, roses growing in January, people living in the open all the year round. Suddenly he looked straight at me.
"Tell me," he asked, "is it true what your sister said, that after working all day in the laundry you go to school at night? We've got to bring you to Los Angeles. There you'll get the roses back into your cheeks."
He seized my hand in a flow of sympathy and stroked the callous rough spots the laundry had stamped on them.
"These hands should be playing the piano, not ironing clothes."
Finer than silk and velvet was the touch of his hand on mine. I wanted to hold myself back from him, but everything in me rushed out to him.
"Let's go out," he said. "Where shall I take you?"
"Go on talking only."
"I talk enough all day, buying and selling. When I'm through with business, I want to play and forget myself. How would you like a vaudeville show?"
He put his strong hands under my elbows. In a flash, I was lifted out of my chair to my feet. That man was so full of compelling force when his eyes turned on me that I had to do what he wanted. I found myself entering a vaudeville theater. There was a chorus of dancing women. A disgusting-looking comedian with a false red nose wagged his finger and leered grossly at the shimmying shoulders. He was cracking jokes about the different women, and each time he came to the point of a joke, Max Goldstein clapped his hands and feet and shouted with laughter.
"Why isn't this funny to me? Am I so thick?" I asked myself.
I felt like a mummy sitting there. At first I couldn't help myself. When Max turned to me to share his enjoyment, I tried to smile, but inside I felt sort of sickened. Max saw that his hearty laughter at the show shocked me and pushed us apart.
"Come on," he patted me indulgently. "I'll take you to something more your kind."
He put me into a taxicab and whirled me uptown among the glittering electric lights of Broadway. We stopped in front of a highly lighted place. Loud strains of music poured out as a man in uniform swung open the door for us. I was frightened about going in at first. I thought it might be another foolishness like the vaudeville show, but the next moment I was in a dazzle of lights and bright colored walls. The brass band lifted me fiercely out of myself and shook me to the roots. Crowds! What crowds of couples! Women's white shoulders against men's black coats, women and men letting go toward each other, drunk with the fiery rhythm of jazz. Ah, just to dance, to lose myself in the mad joy of the crowd, whirl away wild and free from all worry and care. This was the life. Worth everything to taste such a moment of happiness.
He took me into his open arms, and off we went. Such a dancer as Max was. He glided over the floor, a thing of wings. Lost and forgotten were all thoughts of lessons. The joy of the dance burst loose the shut-in prisoner in me. I was a bird that had leaped out of her cage. Wild gladness sang in my veins, swept me up, up, away from this earth.
"I'll say you're some dancer," cried Max, plumping me into a seat at one of the tables. "Say, you've come to life. I saw it was in you first sight off." "But it's 1 o'clock, little teacher in. You must be starved for supper."
The very word 1 o'clock startled me. I suddenly felt tired and began to yawn.
"Better take me home. I've never been out so late."
"Late?" Max scoffed. "Our best good time will just begin."
"No, oh no," I insisted. "I've got to go home. I have work the next day."
His lips drooped sulkily as he looked into my eyes and saw the iron will in me.
I felt his chill at the door and wondered whether he'd come back to see me again.
"But I'm a person with a mind as much as he," I said. "If there's anything real, deep between us, he'll come back. And if he doesn't, I don't want him."
I was too excited to sleep the few hours that were left of that night after Max Goldstein left me. When I glanced at myself in the mirror, I was amazed at my shining face. I was laughing in myself like one bewitched with happiness.
Overnight, I had become a changed person. The weight of ages that had burdened me down since I was a child had dropped away from me.
Overnight, youth burst loose in me, and all because of a man who took me out for one night's pleasure. A fierce desire for life was let loose in me. I had tasted pleasure, and it burned in me for more. More. All day at the laundry, my head was flying away from me like a lost thing in the air. In the evening, I was wondering, should I be absent from school? Because I was too much on fire to come down to the cold facts of lessons. And yet I jollied myself that I didn't want him to come till I could calm down, back to common sense. I told myself I wanted peace and quiet after so much high-flying pleasure. But all the time, a thin, needle-like craving in me was wishing and hoping and aching for him to come. And when his knock came at my door, wild gladness leaped up in me, and I rushed to let him in. His eyes were dancing out of his head with happiness. He held a telegram in his hand, which he waved in my face. "Just got this wire from my agent. People offering me 20,000 for a lot that I bought for 5,000. And think only, I wired back not to close the deal for less than 50,000. Real estate is booming in Los Angeles, the biggest boom in all America." And he went on pouring out to me all his get-rich-quick schemes that would turn him into a millionaire. Last night, his adventures were new and interesting. But now again, his talking only about himself and his business began to get on my nerves. Why don't he ask how I am? Why isn't he interested in my school, my studies? Was the whole world only the boom, boom, boom of his real estate schemes?
"Come, get ready, my little teacher-in. Tonight we'll go to the Grand Street Theater."
"I'm too tired after so much excitement last night. Wouldn't you like better a quiet evening in the park?"
"Ach, I couldn't sit still and be quiet 5 minutes. I've got to be on the go. I've got to see things moving before my eyes. Excitement is like eating to me. In my town, I belong to about a dozen lodges. Every night I'm on the go to a different meeting."
"Anyone listening to you would think that lodge meetings and money-making are the beginning and the end of life."
"Sure thing. Money-making is the biggest game in America. At the lodge meetings, I combine my business and my pleasure. It's meeting people, matching wits. If my luck keeps up, I'll have enough in a few years to sit back and live on my income."
He jerked about restlessly, telling me again of all the real estate he owned and the lots he expected to see, and those he sold at the beginning of his business career. His rushing torrent of money, beat down on me till I suddenly felt worn out. But Max Goldstein took my hat and coat off my nail on the door and threw them at me playfully.
"If you hurry, we'll have time enough to go to the restaurant before the show."
"I'm no excitement eater like you."
"Ach, you talk just like an old maid. You ought to get out into the world. Then you'd wake up."
I stared at him, hurt, frightened. Am I an old maid? I set my teeth to hold back the bitter thoughts crowding in my throat. How I hated him! He and I? No. No, I shivered at the thought of it. It could never be, he and I. Never. Then suddenly he became aware of my silence.
"Come. Come."
He put his hand over mine and stroked my fingers. His touch was like magic. Feelings from under the earth blazed up in me. I pulled my hand away in fear of this power he had over me.
"I'll tell you the truth. I like you more because you're independent. There's a magnet inside of you. It pulls me out of my senses. What's happening to me? You're so different. You're so cold. You're only books, books, books. I sometimes wonder, are you at all a woman? And yet you set me on fire."
His eyes burned into mine. The next moment, he was like a child begging for affection. In a daze, I followed him. I found myself sitting opposite him at a little table in a restaurant. The music, the lights. He and I alone together in a corner all by ourselves. The very air fanned the rush of feeling between us.
"What shall I order for you, little heart?"
"Anything. Anything. You order." My hand ached to touch the curly head bent toward me across the table. Food came, but I was too bewildered to know what I was eating. His eyes, his voice, the nearness of him swept me out of myself with joy and longing. With what innocent delight he watched me put every bite in my mouth.
Eat, darling. Get a little fat on you.
He poured sunlight over me with every breath. What did anything matter except this irresistible gladness that drew us toward each other? Every evening next week he came to see me. One moment I loved him, the next moment I tried to resist him, wanted to be free of him. One moment he would say something that would rise up like a sword between us, pushing us apart. And then, at the touch of his hand, the look of his eyes, I forgot all his faults. My one need of needs, stronger than my life, was my love to be loved. One evening he was content to stay with me in my room. I read to him a story, The Pavilion on the Lynx. How delighted I was by the thoughtful face that listened to every word. So at last I got him excited about something outside of business. Love had opened this new soul in him. With a new feeling of closeness to him, my eyes looked into his as I shut the book.
"Finished?" he cried eagerly. "You looked so beautiful while you were reading to me, just like a picture." "Now listen to business, darling. I've been figuring out that I'd better cinch that offer of 20,000 for my property. My agents are holding up the deal till I come."
God, so this was in his head when I thought he listened with such wholehearted interest to my story. For the first time since I met him, I could see where he belonged. In silence, I looked at him, wondering how I could have been so carried away by a man who was such a stranger to me.
"The only thing that keeps me here is you, Golden Heart."
He took my hand in both his own.
"The first look I gave you, I knew you were for me. I know I'm a good catch. No wonder all kinds of women are after me,"
he went on, praising himself as if he were goods for sale.
"But I'm such a crazy. I want what I want, and I want you. So what do you say?"
He shoved aside the books that piled my table.
"What for should you waste your time yet with school anymore? You're smart enough the way you are. Only dumbheads fool themselves that education and colleges and all that sort of nonsense will push them on in the world. It's money that makes the wheels go round. With my money I can have college graduates working for me, for my agents, my bookkeepers, my lawyers. I can hire them and fire them. And they, with all their education, are under my feet, just because I got the money."
The man seemed to turn into a talking roll of dollar bills right there before my eyes. His smile. He could buy everything. That's what laughed in his eyes. He could buy everything. To him, a wife would only be another piece of property. I grew cold at the thought how near I had been to marrying him. A great calmness came over me. We were so far apart, it was as if someone else was talking for me. "I'm only happy alone. You were right once. I am an old maid." For a long time, after Max left, I could not tear my eyes away from the chair where he had sat, from the spot on the floor that his feet had touched. Max wanted to marry me. Me he wanted. Me. I turned to the mirror and saw myself with new wonder. There was a glow in my face that was never there before. Gone was that vague gaze at nothing. My eyes had grown bigger and darker. They had become seeing eyes. I had seen and felt. I had tasted and known. And it shone there, in my eyes, and surged through my arms and fingers. I touched the hand he had touched, my face, my neck. There was a feel like new velvet on my skin. I knew now the meaning of a certain inner smile that I used to see in certain women's eyes. I felt that same smile in me. My head went up with a new pride. I had an assurance that I never had before. I was thrilled, flattered, ripened for love. Then why did I let him go? Hours I sat there, my head in my hands, wondering why. Slowly, one piece of a broken thought began to weave itself together with another. If I'd let myself love him, I'd end by hating him. He only excited me, but that wasn't enough. Even in the ecstasy of our kisses, I knew he was not my kind. I looked at the books on my table that had stared at me like enemies a little while before. They were again the life of my life. Ach, nothing was so beautiful as to learn, to know, to master by the sheer force of my will even the dead squares and triangles of geometry. I seized my books and hugged them to my breast as though they were living things. Chapter 15. On and on, alone. A sudden longing to see my father came over me. I felt that my refusal to marry Max Goldstein was something he could understand. He had given up worldly success to drink the wisdom of the Torah. He would tell me that, after all, I was the only daughter of his faith. I had lived the old, old story which he had drilled into our childhood ears, the story of Jacob and Esau. I had it from father, this ingrained something in me that would not let me take the mess of pottage. For the whole day after, I thought of father. If I only could talk myself out to him. Now I could love and understand him from afar, as I had once hated him and could not bear him when near. I had broken away from him as a child, only to be drawn to him now, in my great spiritual need, as a person is drawn to a person. Some of his preachings came back to me.
Can fire and water live together? Neither can godliness and an easy life.
How rich with the sap of centuries were his words of wisdom! I never knew the meaning of his sayings when I had to listen to him at home. But now it came over me like half-remembered, far-off songs, like music and poetry. When I came back from work, I had a great urge to drop everything and take the train to Elizabeth and rush home to see him. Never since I was born did I feel such a great need for him and his wiser-than-the-world kind of wisdom. I still remember how I sat there in my room glued to my chair instead of jumping up to take the train as I wanted to do. Something was holding me back, and I always wondered whether it wasn't my instinct that he was even then coming down the block to me. He seemed coming closer and closer to me, and I was scarcely surprised, but only thrilled and happy, when I heard the familiar stamping of his feet. It was like the answering of a prayer, to see before my eyes my door open, and my father standing there like a picture out of the Bible. Had a miracle happened? My father come to see me? In a rush of gladness, words from Isaiah flashed before me as in letters of fire. I will join the hearts of the parents and the children. Never had there been any show of feeling between father and us children. Only once a year, on the Day of Atonement, he put his hands over our heads to bless us. Now, as I looked at him, he seemed to me like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Solomon, and David, all joined together in the one wise old face. And this man with all the ancient prophets shining out of his eyes. My father.
I longed to rush forward and fling my arms around his neck.
Father,
I cried. And then my voice stopped, for I suddenly became aware of his cold, hard glance on me.
Is it true what Max Goldstein said?
His eyes glared.
Is it true you refused him?
My heart stopped. I just stared at him. Not a word could force itself out of my tight throat.
Answer me! Answer me!
His voice grew louder and harsher.
It wasn't the real love, I stammered, hardly aware what I was saying.
Love you want yet? What do you know about love? How could any man love a lawless, conscienceless thing like you?
I never dreamed that a decent man would want to marry you.
You had a chance to make a good ending to a bad play, and you push away such luck match with your own hands. I always knew you were crazy. Now I see you're your own worst enemy.
All I could feel was the hurt of his beating me down. Just as I looked to father for love, he rose up to stone me.
This was the one chance of your life. Another chance to marry will never come to you. There are plenty of nicer girls than you, younger, more beautiful. Home girls, those are the girls men want. What have you to show off to a man? The shame and disgrace that you heaped upon your old father? A lawless daughter makes a lawless wife. No man wants to marry a girl who runs away from home.
Rage flamed from his eyes as he thundered at me, stamping his feet.
Pfui on your education! What's going to be your end? A dried-up old maid? You think you can make over the world? You think millions of educated old maids like you could change the world one inch? Woe to America, where women are let free like men! All that's false in politics, prohibition, and all the evils of the world come from them.
I no longer saw my father before me, but a tyrant from the old world where only men were people.
To him I was nothing but his last unmarried daughter to be bought and sold. Even in my revolt I could not keep back a smile. It's no use talking to you. I see to my sorrow that my words won't help you. He who loses his understanding is like one spiritually sick. Right is wrong to him, and wrong is right. It says in the Torah, what's a woman without a man? Less than nothing, a blotted out existence. No life on earth, and no hope of heaven.
He drew himself back like a deposed king who had been wounded and dishonored. There was a hurt, a sorrow in his eyes that hurt me and made me weak with guilt against him.
It bleeds in me, my heart, when I see how you're digging your own ruin, and you won't listen to my warning. After all, you're my child, flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood.
My God, I am flesh of his flesh and blood of his blood. Why can't he understand me? Why don't we understand each other?
Full of bitterness, I cried to him, what do you want from me? Why do you torture me?
My child, he pleaded, hear me. I'm an old man. I lived longer than you. I know what's good for you better than you know. Look around you. Nothing in nature lives by itself alone. Every tree has its little branch. Every branch has its little flower. God put people on earth to get married and have children yet. It says in the Torah, breed and multiply. A woman's highest happiness is to be a man's wife, the mother of a man's children. You're not a person at all. What do you make from yourself? Why do you hold yourself better than the whole world? You hide yourself from people. Never go anywhere, never see anyone. Who ever heard of such madness? You're worse than an animal. Even animals live with one another. The birds in the air, the fishes in the sea, even the littlest worms under the stone need their own kind to fulfill themselves. You'll rot away by yourself.
Why does he throw yet salt on my wounds?
The nails of my fingers dug into my palms, trying to control myself.
Why can't he see how my whole being cried out for love, for sympathy, for the living breath of any kind of people?
Father, I burst out, I want love. I'd give my life away to love and be loved. I want a home, a husband, and children. But Max Goldstein, such a golden young man, he isn't good enough for you yet? You're yet blowing from yourself. Who do you think you are? Whom do you want? The President of America, maybe?
I saw there was no use talking. He could never understand. He was the old world. I was the new.
I give you up. He spat his rage in my face. You're without character, without morals, without religion. What use are you to yourself or to the world? When you'll die, they'll bury you in Potter's Field, among all the bums and outcasts of America.
I have to live and die by what's in me, I said dully. Preaching don't change me. Why don't you let me alone?
Wait. You'll see your bitter end when you begin to grow older. I warn you, your terrible selfishness.
All my selfishness is from you.
I was stung at last to hitting back at him.
What have you ever done for your wife and children but crush them and break them? I ran away from home because I hated you. I couldn't bear the sight of you.
Schlong? Toad? Wild animal? Thing of evil? How came you ever to be my child? I disown you. I curse you. May your name and your memory be blotted out of this earth.
He rushed from me, slamming the door. A defeated prophet, a Jeremiah to whom the people would not listen. I knew now that I was alone. I had to give up the dreams of any understanding from Father as I had to give up the longing for love from Max Goldstein. Those two experiences made me clear to myself. Knowledge was what I wanted more than anything else in the world. I had made my choice, and now I had to pay the price. So this is what it cost, daring to follow the urge in me. No father, No lover, no family, no friend. I must go on and on. And I must go on. Alone.
Chapter 16. College.
That burning day when I got ready to leave New York and start out on my journey to college. I felt like Columbus starting out for the other end of the earth. I felt like the Pilgrim Fathers who had left their homeland and all their kin behind them and trailed out in search of the new world. I had stayed up night after night, washing and ironing, patching and darning my things. At last, I put them all together in a bundle, wrapped them up with newspapers, and tied them securely with the thick clothesline that I had in my room on which to hang out my wash. I made another bundle of my books. In another newspaper, I wrapped up my food for the journey, a loaf of bread, a herring, and a pickle. In my purse was the money I had been saving from my food, from my clothes, a penny to a penny, a dollar to a dollar, for so many years. It was not much, but I counted out that it would be enough for my train ticket and a few weeks' start till I got work out there. It was only when I got to the train that I realized I had hardly eaten all day. Starving hungry, I tore the paper open. Ach, crazy head! In my haste, I had forgotten even to cut up the bread. I bent over on the side of my seat, and half covering myself with a newspaper, I pinched pieces out of the loaf and ripped ravenously at the herring. With each bite, I cast side glances like a guilty thing. Nobody should see the way I ate. After a while, as the lights were turned low, the other passengers began to nod their heads, each outsnoring the other in their thick sleep. I was the only one on the train too excited to close my eyes. Like a dream was the whole night's journey, and like a dream mounting on a dream was this college town, this new America of culture education. Before this, New York was all of America to me, but now I came to a town of quiet streets shaded with greens. No crowds, no tenements, no hurrying noise to beat the race of the hours. Only a leisured quietness whispered in the air. Peace. Be still. Eternal time is all before you. Each house had its own green grass in front, its own free space all around, and it faced the street with the calm security of being owned for generations and not rented by the month from a landlord. In the early twilight, it was like a picture out of fairyland to see people sitting on their porches, lazily swinging in their hammocks, or watering their own growing flowers. So these are the real Americans, I thought, thrilled by the lean, straight bearing of the passers-by. They had none of that terrible fight for bread and rent that I always saw in New York people's eyes. Their faces were not worn with the hunger for things they never could have in their lives. There was in them that sure, settled look of those who belong to the world in which they were born. The college buildings were like beautiful palaces. The campus stretched out like fields of a big park. Air. Air. Free space and sunshine. The river at dusk. Glimmering lights on passing boats. The floating voices of young people. And when night came, there were the sky and the stars. This was the beauty for which I had always longed. For the first few days I could only walk about and drink it in thirstily, more and more. Beauty of houses, beauty of streets, beauty shining out of the calm faces and cool eyes of the people. Oh, too cool. How could I most quickly become friends with them? How could I come into their homes, exchange with them my thoughts, break with them bread at their tables? If I could only lose myself, body and soul, in the serenity of this new world, the hunger and the turmoil of my ghetto years would drop away from me, and I too would know the beauty of stillness and peace. What light-hearted, laughing youth met my eyes. All the young people I had ever seen were shut up in factories, but here were young girls and young men enjoying life, free from the worry for a living. College to them was being out for a good time, like to us in the shop a Sunday picnic. But in our gayest Sunday picnics there was always the underfeeling that Monday meant back to the shop again. To these born lucky ones, joy seemed to stretch out forever. What a sight I was in my gray pushcart clothes against the beautiful gay colors and the fine things that those young girls wore. I had seen cheap, fancy style, 5 and 10 cent store finery. but never had I seen such plain beautifulness.
The simple skirts and sweaters, the stockings and shoes to match, the neat finished quietness of their tailored suits. There was no show-off in their clothes, and yet how much more pulling to the eyes and all the senses than the Grand Street richness I knew.
And the spick-and-span cleanliness of these people?
It smelled from them, the soap and the bathing, their fingernails so white and pink, their hands and necks white like milk. I wondered how did those girls get their hair so soft, so shiny and so smooth about their heads. Even their black shoes had a clean look.
Never had I seen men so all shaved up with pink clean skins. The richest storekeepers in Grand Street shined themselves up with diamonds like walking jewelry stores, but they weren't so hollering clean as these men. And they all had their hair clipped so short. They all had a shape to their heads. So ironed out, smooth, and even, they looked in their spotless, creaseless clothes as if the dirty battle of life had never yet been on them.
I looked at these children of joy with a million eyes. I looked at them with my hands, my feet, with the thinnest nerves of my hair. By all their differences from me, their youth, their shiny freshness, their carefreeness, they pulled me out of my senses to them, and they didn't even know I was there.
I thought once I got into the classes with them, they'd see me and we'd get to know one another.
What a sharp awakening came with my first hour.
As I entered the classroom, I saw young men and girls laughing and talking to one another without introductions.
I looked for my seat.
Then I noticed, up in front, a very earnest-faced young man with thick glasses over his sad eyes. He made me think of Morris Lipkin, so I chose my seat next to him.
"What's the name of the professor?" I asked.
"Smith," came from his tight lips.
He did not even look at me.
He pulled himself together and began busily writing to show me he didn't want to be interrupted. I turned to the girl on my other side.
What a fresh, clean beauty, a creature of sunshine, and clothes that matched her radiant youth. "Is this the freshman class in geometry?" I asked her.
She nodded politely and smiled,
but how quickly her eyes sized me up. It was not an unkind glance.
And yet, it said more plainly than words,
"From where do you come? How did you get in here?"
Sitting side by side with them through the whole hour, I felt stranger to them than if I had passed them in Hester Street. Wasn't there some secret something that would open us toward one another? In one class after another, I kept asking myself, "What's the matter with me? Why do they look at me so when I talk with them? Maybe I'd have to change myself inside and out to be one of them. But how?" The lectures were over at 4 o'clock. With a sigh, I turned from the college building, away from the pleasant streets, down to the shabby back alley near the post office, and entered the George Martin hand laundry. Mr. Martin was a fat, easygoing, good-natured man. I no sooner told him of my experience in New York than he took me on at once as an ironer at 50 cents an hour, and he told me he had work for as many hours a day as I could put in. I felt if I could only look a little bit like other girls on the outside, maybe I could get in with them. And that meant money. And money meant work, work, work. Till 11 o'clock that night, I ironed fancy white shirtwaists.
"You're some busy little worker, even if I do say so," said Mr. Martin good-naturedly. "But I must lock up. You can't live here."
I went home, aching in every bone, and in the quiet and good air I so overslept that I was late for my first class. To make matters worse, I found a note in my mailbox that puzzled and frightened me. It said, "Please report at once to the dean's office to explain your absence from Physical Education 1 at 4 o'clock.
A line of other students was waiting there. When my turn came, I asked the secretary, "What's this physical education business?"
"This is a compulsory course," he said. "You cannot get credit in any other course unless you satisfy this requirement."
At the hour when I had intended to go back to Martin's laundry, I entered the big gymnasium. There were a crowd of girls dressed in funny short black bloomers and rubber-soled shoes.
The teacher blew the whistle and called harshly,
"Students are expected to report in their uniforms."
"I have none."
"They're to be obtained at the bookstore," she said with a stern look at me. Please do not report again without it.
I stood there dumb.
Well, stay for today and exercise as you are, said the teacher, taking pity on me.
She pointed out my place in the line, where I had to stand with the rest like a lot of wooden soldiers. She made us twist ourselves around here and there.
Right face, left face, right about face.
I tried to do as the others did, but I felt like a jumping jack being pulled this way and that way. I picked up dumbbells and pushed them up and down and sideways until my arms were lame. Then she made us hop around like a lot of monkeys.
At the end of the hour, I was so out of breath that I sank down, my heart pounding against my ribs. I was dripping with sweat worse than Saturday night in the steam laundry.
What's all this physical education nonsense? I came to college to learn something, to get an education with my head and not monkey shines with my arms and legs.
I went over to the instructor.
How much an hour do we get for this work? I asked her bitterly.
She looked at me with a stupid stare.
This is a 2-point course.
Now I got real mad. I've got to sweat my life away enough only to earn a living, I cried. God knows I exercised enough since I was a kid.
You properly exercised?
She looked at me from head to foot.
Your posture is bad. Your shoulders sag. You need additional corrective exercises outside the class.
More tired than ever, I came to the class next day.
After the dumbbells, she made me jump over the hurdles. For the life of me, I couldn't do it. I bumped myself and scratched my knees on the top bar of the hurdle, knocking it over with a great clatter. They all laughed, except the teacher.
Repeat the exercise, please,
she said with a frozen face.
I was all bruises trying to do it, and they were holding their sides with laughter. I was their clown, and this was their circus. And suddenly I got so wild with rage that I seized the hurdle, and right before their eyes I smashed it to pieces. The whole gymnasium went still as death. The teacher's face was white.
Report at once to the dean.
The scared look on the faces of the girls made me feel that I was to be locked up or fired. For a minute, when I entered the dean's grand office, I was so confused I couldn't even see. He rose and pointed to a chair beside his desk.
What can I do for you?
He asked in a voice that quieted me as he spoke. I told him how mad I was to have piled on me jumping hurdles when I was so tired anyway. He regarded me with that cooling steadiness of his. When I was through, he walked to the window and I waited, miserable. Finally, he turned to me again, and with a smile.
I'm quite certain that physical education is not essential in your case. I will excuse you from attending the course.
After this, things went better with me. In spite of the hard work in the laundry, I managed to get along in my classes. More and more interesting became the life of the college as I watched it from the outside.
What a feast of happenings each day of college was to those other students. Societies, dances, letters from home, packages of food, midnight spreads, and even birthday parties. I never knew that there were people glad enough of life to celebrate the day they were born. I watched the gay goings-on around me like one coming to a feast, but always standing back and only looking on. One day the ache for people broke down my feelings of difference from them. I felt I must tear myself out of my aloneness. Nothing had ever come to me without my going out after it. I had to fight for my living, fight for every bit of my education. Why should I expect friendship and love to come to me out of the air while I sat there dreaming about it? The freshman class gave a dance that very evening. Something in the back of my head told me that an evening dress and slippers were part of going to a dance. I had no such things. But should that stop me? If I had waited till I could afford the right clothes for college, I should never have been able to go at all. I put a fresh collar over my old serge dress, and with a dollar stolen from my eating money, I bought a ticket to the dance. As I peeped into the glittering gymnasium, blaring with jazz, my timid fears stopped the breath in me. How the whole big place sang with their light-hearted happiness. Young eyes drinking joy from young eyes. Girls like gay-colored butterflies whirling in the arms of young men. Floating ribbons and sashes shimmered against men's black coats. I took the nearest chair, blinded by the dazzle of the happy couples. Why did I come here?
A terrible sense of age weighed upon me. Yet I watched and waited for someone to come and ask me to dance. But not one man came near me. Some of my classmates nodded distantly in passing, but most of them were too filled with their own happiness even to see me. The whirling joy went on, and still I sat there watching, cold, lifeless, like a lost ghost. I was nothing and nobody. It was worse than being ignored, worse than being an outcast. I simply didn't belong. I had no existence in their young eyes. I wanted to run and hide myself, but fear and pride nailed me against the wall. A chaperone must have noticed my face, and she brought over one of those clumsy, backward youths who was lost in a corner by himself. How unwilling were his feet as she dragged him over! In a dull voice, he asked, "May I have the next dance?" His eyes fixed in the distance as he spoke.
"Thank you. I don't want to dance."
And I fled from the place. I found myself walking in the darkness of the campus. In the thick shadows of the trees, I hid myself and poured out my shamed and injured soul to the night. So it wasn't character or brains that counted, only youth and beauty and clothes, things I never had and never could have. Joy and love were not for such as me. Why not? Why not? I flung myself on the ground, beating with my fists against the endless sorrows of my life. Even in college, I had not escaped from the ghetto. Here, loneliness hounded me even worse than in Hester Street. Was there no escape? Will I never lift myself to be a person among people? I pressed my face against the earth. All that was left of me reached out in prayer.
God, I've gone so far. Help me to go on. God, I don't know how, but I must go on. Help me not to want their little happiness. I have wanted their love more than my life. Help me be bigger than this hunger in me. Give me the love that can live without love.
Darkness and stillness washed over me. Slowly I stumbled to my feet and looked up at the sky. The stars in their infinite peace seemed to pour their healing light into me. I thought of captives in prison, the sick and the suffering from the beginning of time who had looked to these stars for strength. What was my little sorrow to the centuries of pain which those stars had watched? So near they seemed, so compassionate. My bitter hurt seemed to grow small and drop away. If I must go on alone, I should still have silence and the high stars to walk with me. Never before or since in all my life had I worked as hard as during the first term. I was not only earning a living and getting an education, I was trying to break into this new college world. Every week I saved a bit more for a little something in my appearance, a brush for the hair, a pair of gloves, a pair of shoes with stockings to match. And now I began to work still longer hours to save up for a plain felt hat like those college girls wore. And the result of my wanting to dress up was that I was too tired to master my hardest subject. In January, the blow fell. On the bulletin board, where everybody could see, my name was posted as failing in geometry. It meant taking the course all over again. And something still worse. 2 weeks later, the bursar sent me a bill for the same old geometry class. I hurried to his office and pushed myself in ahead of the line of waiting students.
"I want my money back for the geometry course that you didn't teach me," I cried. "I paid to learn, not fail."
The man gaped at me for a moment as if I had gone mad, and then paid no more attention to me. His indifference got me into such a rage that I could have broken through the cage and shaken him. But I remembered the smashed hurdle and the kind dean. With an effort, I got hold of myself and went to this more understanding man.
"I didn't smash any hurdles, but I'm ready to smash the world. Why should I pay the college for something I didn't get?"
And then I told him how they wanted to cheat me. This time, even the dean did not understand. And I had no new hat that winter. I flung myself into the next term's work with a fierce determination to wring the last drop of knowledge from each course. At first, psychology was like Greek to me. So many words about words. Apperception, reflex arc, inhibitions. What had all that fancy book language to do with the real, plain everyday? Then one day, Mr. Edmund said to the class,
"Give an example from your own experience showing how anger or any strong emotion interferes with your thinking."
Suddenly, it dawned on me. I jumped to my feet with excitement. I told him about Zalman the fish peddler. Once I saw him get so mad at a woman for wanting to bargain down a penny on a pound of fish that in his anger he threw a dollar's worth of change at her. In a flash, so many sleeping things in my life woke up in me. I remembered the time I was so crazy for Morris Lipkin, how I had poured out all my feelings without sense. That whole picture of my first mad love sprang before my eyes like a new revelation, and I cried, "No wonder they say all lovers are fools!" Everybody laughed. But my anger did not get the better of me now. I had learned self-control. I was now a person of reason. From that day on, the words of psychology were full of living wonder. In a few weeks, I was ahead of anyone else in the class. I saw the students around me as so many pink-faced children who never had had to live yet. I realized that the time when I sold herring in Hester Street, I was learning life more than if I had gone to school. The fight with Father to break away from home, the fight in the cafeteria for a piece of meat. When I went through those experiences, I thought them privations and losses. Now I saw them treasure chests of insight. What countless riches lay buried under the ground of those early years that I had thought so black, so barren, so thwarted with want. Before long, I had finished the whole textbook of psychology. "I'm through with the book," I said to Mr. Edmund. "Please give me more work. I've got to keep my head going." He gave me a list of references, and I was so excited with the first new book that I stayed up half the night reading it on and on. I could hardly wait for the class to show Mr. Edmund all I had learned. After the lecture, I hastened to his desk. "I'm all ready to recite on this new book," I cried as I handed it to him.
"Recite?"
He looked puzzled. "Ask me any questions. See only how much I've just learned."
"I'm late to a class right now. I'm busy with lectures all day long."
"If you're busy all day, I'll come to you in the evening. Where do you live?"
He drew back and stared at me. "I'm glad to tell you what to read," he said stiffly. "But I have no time for recitations outside of class hours. I'm too busy."
God, how his indifference cut me. Too busy? The miser. Here I come to him hungry, starving, come begging for one little crumb of knowledge, and he has it all, and yet pushes me back with, "I'm too busy." How I had dreamed of college.
The inspired companionship of teachers who are friends,
the high places above the earth where minds are fired by minds.
And what's this place I've come to? Was the college only a factory, and the teachers machines turning out lectures by the hour on wooden dummies incapable of response? Was there no time for the flash from eye to eye?